the fifth case, United States v. Jones.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, counsel. This case presents one singular issue, and that is whether an alleged defaced .22 caliber rifle, not charged in the indictment and not proved at sentencing as relevant conduct, can form the basis of an enhancement under Guideline 2K2.1B4.
Before we get to the merits of that legal issue, the case is very peculiarly postured.
Yes, I was getting to that,
it's
actually.
It's hard to say, but it definitely is, and raises some jurisdictional issues, or at least potential jurisdictional issues. As I understand it, you took an appeal from the entry of an amended judgment in the underlying criminal case.
Yes.
That's why this is captioned United States against Jones instead of the other way around, which is the usual way a 2255 habeas would be captioned, because it's an appeal from the amended judgment in the criminal case. But the amended judgment is the same as the original judgment insofar as the sentence that it's imposed. So there isn't any change. As I understand the record, is that right? The same sentence was imposed.
Same sentence was imposed.
So no habeas relief was granted in terms of a different sentence?
No. The only habeas relief granted was there was a finding that trial counsel was ineffective for failing a notice of appeal.
But no habeas relief was granted from that?
No. But in Judge Lindbergh's order, which is at the last part of the appendix,
right,
he directs me to take up my problem with the Seventh Circuit.
Right, but in the process, as part of that order, also denies all habeas relief. And I understand the predicament you're in. You're just doing what the district judge told you to
do. Yes, and I was like...
But that wasn't really the right instruction, was it?
Well, I have my own opinion about the denial of the habeas relief, because I thought this was a very systemically problematic case for the defendant.
Right, I understand that, and that's the issue that you want to get to and that you were trying to raise, and the district judge told you don't do it in an appeal from the denial of habeas relief, do it in an appeal from
exactly.
The entry of the amended judgment, and so that's why we're here this way. But was that the appropriate procedure, notwithstanding what the district judge told you to do?
Well, I think it is, because I think you can raise ineffective assistance of counsel at sentencing if it's within the record. On a direct appeal. And this is really within the record, the conduct that I'm referring to.
But we didn't have it on direct appeal. Because no direct
appeal. I'm doing
appeal.
The direct appeal from the sentencing. And in that sentencing, there was error committed.
But there was no direct appeal of that original sentencing decision and entry of judgment of conviction and sentence. That's the problem. There should have been.
And so here I am left with this direct appeal after the amended judgment. This is a direct appeal. And I raise what I see that's within the record that was problematic. And that's why I'm here doing this now.
Okay.
So I was going to say that this case is like the issue is uniquely formulated under the ineffective assistance of counsel. But so the question is, if you'll ultimately entertain that, because I think that it is within the record that you can determine whether or not trial counsel performed substandardly. I think that also in the sentencing context, and that's the only reason I'm here is in the sentencing context. That's the only reason I'm able to be here, because nothing else was preserved. So I think the law is very clear that any additional amount of time that somebody gets because of trial counsel's failures is ineffective. And Mr. Jones is currently serving, in my view, two to three years more than he would have if his counsel had called the prosecutor to task in this case regarding the .22 caliber. So what I think happened here was that the probation officer, and I think correctly, and the government disagrees, grouped counts 3, 4, and 5, which were the felon in possession of a weapon, felon in possession of 8 firearms or more, and count 5, which is possession of a firearm with obliterated serial number, but not the firearm I'm talking about. They couldn't charge him with that because they couldn't prove that it was a federal offense. They couldn't prove that that .22 caliber rifle traveled in interstate commerce. So what the probation officer did was he grouped all of those counts correctly, I think, under 3D1.2, C and D, and then what he did was he took this .22 caliber, because at that time you'd get 2 extra points for having an alleged or a proven obliterated serial, a gun with obliterated serial number. He took that gun and he enhanced 2 more levels. And it's my position, it's our position, that, first of all, I don't think the government will argue that relevant conduct has to be proved by the preponderance of evidence if it's not admitted. And my client never admitted that that .22 caliber was a violation of federal law or state law. It never traveled in interstate commerce. They could never prove it did. And so he didn't admit it. So then here we are. We've got this enhancement with no proof, and trial counsel does nothing. And the government, as I said, admits that they basically couldn't prove it, and they say in their version of offense that, you know, everything traveled in interstate commerce except probably the .22. So I believe that the enhancement, the requirement of this section of the guideline, is that this offense, that this .22 caliber that you're using to enhance is an actual offense, which means it actually traveled interstate commerce. And it never was proven, and it was substandard conduct on the part of trial counsel not to object to that.
Here's my problem. We're talking about a sentence enhancement here rather than a change in the indictment. So why wouldn't the enhancement apply to the rifle irrespective of whether the rifle ever traveled in interstate commerce? In other words, if the possession of the rifle is illegal in the state of Illinois, and under Illinois law, as the government has suggested, wouldn't it constitute relevant conduct to which the sentence enhancement would apply? After all, he possessed the rifle at the very same time and in the same place as the other 8 weapons that are identified in count 4. And nothing in the guidelines seems to require a link to interstate commerce.
Well, I think there's things throughout the guideline, particularly the application notes for this particular enhancement, that does say, and now it's application note 8, just for your convenience, and it says if the offense involved a firearm with an obliterated serial number, the offense. Where's the offense? He wasn't charged with this. Where's the offense? And moreover, I think
the offense is in having all 8 of these.
Which the .22 is not included in that. It's excluded. So in that particular, that was a 4-level enhancement for those guns, but the .22 wasn't included in that. And
do you mean it wasn't included because the probation officer thought it would be double counting, or?
No, I think it wasn't included because
it wasn't an offense.
It wasn't an offense, the .22. And, you know, I looked at the case that was decided by this circuit, United States versus Statham, and it addressed this section. And it had language in there that led me to believe this position was accurate. You state in there, when you're analyzing 2K2.1B4, you say, the court need to find only that one of the guns involved in the crime was in fact missing a serial number. We've got no guns involving in the crime that are missing a serial number. In regard to, Judge Rovner, in regard to your question about state law, that was never raised.
Well,
it was never raised, and it doesn't that also have to be proved by the preponderance of the evidence?
Well,
that it did indeed violate state law?
Well, we know that his possession of the rifle is unlawful under state law. We know this.
That's a legal question here.
Both because he was a felon and because the serial number was obliterated. So, as such, his possession, it seems to me, of the rifle constitutes relevant conduct. You know, and because possession of the rifle qualifies as relevant conduct, the sentencing enhancement applies to the rifle. And nothing in 2K21B4 turns on whether the firearm travels in interstate commerce. The guidelines of the calls for a two-level enhancement if any firearm had an obliterated serial number. And the definition of firearm is limited to those arms which have some link to some sort of link to interstate commerce. So it was proper to base the enhancement on the .22 caliber rifle. I don't know.
Is that my red light? Does that mean?
It is, but you may certainly respond.
Briefly, there was really one complication that I believe would have come to light if it would have been litigated, and that was it never admitted or proved that .22 caliber was his, and there was this whole question of the apartment that was searched and where things were found, and I think that if it had been challenged, I don't think it would have been as easy as it sounds here that the government would have prevailed on having that become relevant conduct.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Chapp.
May it please the Court. The defendant's trial counsel in this case rendered constitutionally effective assistance of counsel at the defendant's sentencing. The reason we're getting a Strickland argument on a direct appeal is because the Court did find that the trial counsel failed to file a notice of appeal, or at least we didn't. We conceded that we couldn't overcome the defendant's prima facie showing that that his trial counsel failed to follow his instructions to follow an appeal. So in order to remedy that, there was a remedy for that, the remedy being the entry of the amended judgment.
But it's the very same sentence, so there was no finding of prejudice. Otherwise, the sentence would have been different.
Well, I think the prejudice was that he lost the right to challenge whatever was in the district court record, as opposed to the end result that the district court would have imposed a different sentence.
Did the judge make a prejudice finding on Strickland?
I don't recall, Your Honor.
My guess is the answer is no if he entered the same exact sentence. So all we have is an incomplete application of the Strickland test for ineffective assistance of counsel, finding the failure to file an appeal deficient performance, but not knowing whether it had any prejudicial effect on the sentence. And we assume from the fact that the judge imposed the very same sentence that it did not.
He did. He imposed the same sentence, but I guess maybe I'm not seeing this the same way. The issue was whether the defendant should have gotten a chance in the appellate court, as opposed to arguing that his attorney was deficient for failing to raise certain issues in front of that judge or to argue his case differently. In other words, whatever he wanted to challenge in the district court record, he wasn't saying that Judge Lindberg had done anything particularly wrong. And I think the Seventh Circuit has said in the past that when a defendant, it's almost a per se violation of effectiveness for a defense attorney not to file a notice of appeal if his client asks him to do so. The proper procedure being to, if you don't see a meritorious issue, to either to file an Anders brief. But if a client wants to file an appeal and he directs his attorney to do so, the attorney is obligated to do that on behalf of his client, at least for a direct appeal. And so what Judge Lindberg did was he said, you know, you're right, the attorney should have done that, or at least the government is conceding that it can't show that Jones's claim that he told his attorney to file the appeal is correct. So he simply reentered the judgment and said, as Ms. Dompf indicated, he left it in Ms. Dompf's hands to raise whatever arguments she could raise on direct appeal. But I think the reason we're getting the ineffective assistance of counsel argument is because, at least on this issue, is because the trial attorney who handled district court proceedings, Jeff Granich, the defendant waived this issue in the district court. this issue, the government asked it during the district court proceedings in our government's version to apply the B4 enhancement to all the firearms accounts, to or the counts. And I do want to point out there is a mistake in our brief at page 7. We indicate in the brief that we didn't make that request with regard to count 5. That was the count based on the possession of the obliterated FEG firearm. But that's incorrect. We did actually ask it to be applied to all the counts. The defendant in the district court proceedings affirmatively agreed that his offense level was properly calculated. So he affirmatively waived the argument that the court should not have applied the B4 enhancement, regardless of whether that was on the basis of the FEG or the 22 caliber rifle.
Is it clear what the district court based it on, Mr. Chapman? Whether it was the pistol or the rifle?
The district court adopted the probation officer's conclusion. I don't think the judge specified what it was. And in fact, in our government's version, we didn't specify whether we were basing it on the FEG, the 22 rifle, or both.
Right.
But it's no surprise that that didn't happen because the defendant waived the issue. Everyone was in agreement that he starts with an offense level of 32 based on count 3, since that of all the counts grouped together, that was the one that rendered the highest offense level. So we never got into the weeds in terms of which one would apply, which is why ultimately the defendant can't satisfy the performance and prejudice prongs of Strickland in this case, because if the trial court attorney had raised that issue, if he'd gone to Judge Lindberg and said, you know what, I don't think B4 applies here, Judge, then obviously both parties and the judge would have delved more deeply into the law, and I think the result would have been identical to what we see here. In other words, we would have demonstrated that you could apply the enhancement based on the FEG, which had traveled in interstate commerce and was the subject of a substantive count, and you could have applied it on the 22 rifle as well. We don't need to prove, as Judge Rovner pointed out, we don't need to prove that a rifle traveled in interstate commerce if it's being included as relevant conduct. We couldn't show that the 22 rifle traveled in interstate commerce, so it does not form the basis of a substantive count.
Well, you'd have to prove it if it were being used to tally up the number of firearms for purposes of 2K2.1B1, because that the text of that guideline is different from B4.
It is different. I don't know if we'd have to prove interstate commerce, Your Honor. I think that we would have to prove that he possessed the gun unlawfully, which could include both unlawful possession under federal law and unlawful possession under state law as well.
Well, you know, on the last page of your brief, you said that counsel's failure to object to a single guidelines enhancement doesn't rise to the level of ineffective assistance.
Mm-hmm.
But if that failure to object results in additional prison time, surely that's prejudicial, isn't it? I mean, that's a great point. The Supreme Court reversed this circuit on in Glover, as Mr. Jones pointed out.
I think it depends on how severe the deficiency is, Your Honor. A defendant is not entitled to perfect representation by a defense attorney. A defendant is entitled to have a lawyer who's present and actually provides him counsel overall. Now, a single error, there's some suggestion in case law that a single error could be severe enough that that error could be ineffective all by itself, even if the lawyer did everything else correctly.
Yeah, well, my view of an ineffective assistance of counsel is one extra hour in prison.
Right. Well, that certainly would be prejudice, Judge. But the question is not the prejudice prong so much the performance prong, because if we look at the state of the law at the time this was going on, the trial counsel faced with the 2005 guidelines manual would have seen all of the barriers that we've pointed out in this case, including the fact that the plain language, as Your Honor pointed out just now, that the plain language does not require that the firearm travel in interstate commerce. The Statham case doesn't really add anything, frankly, to the analysis. Statham dealt with a completely different issue. It dealt with whether the government has to prove that the defendant was aware of the obliteration. And the language referring to all the firearms within the defendant's crime was not an interpretation of whether uncharged weapons could be included as relevant conduct. The defendant, Statham, was convicted of conspiracy and to traffic weapons, and all the firearms were within the scope of that conspiracy. So the reference to, or the phrase, the court's use of the phrase, within the crime, you know, necessarily encompassed all of the weapons. It wasn't dealing with the fine points or the fine distinctions that we're dealing with here today. But looking at this from the perspective of an attorney in 2006 who has to argue this, in light of the cases that are out there, including Campbell, which we think supports our position, but dealt with a different enhancement, you have the plain language, you have common sense. We point out this hypothetical on the FEG firearm. If we catch a guy on the street and he's got a firearm that traveled in interstate commerce, and it's got an obliterated serial number, if we just charge him with the 922G offense, and under the defendant's theory in this case, we could also get the two-level enhancement for possessing a gun with an obliterated serial number. The application notes make clear that's true whether he knew about the obliteration or not. But if we then charge him in a two-count, instead we charge him in a two-count indictment, and charge him with a 922K offense for the same gun, then suddenly we'd have a double-counting problem, and we couldn't get the two-level enhancement. So by charging him with fewer crimes, he faces a higher sentence for exactly the same conduct. That's completely irrational, of course. And in terms of the real sentencing goals of the guidelines, you also have the situation where if the B4 enhancement were not to apply or only apply to guns that traveled interstate commerce, you could have a situation, again, a hypothetical we throw out at page 28, where somebody who's possessing a tremendous number of weapons, intending to use them for a dangerous purpose, has those weapons, but we just can't show they've moved into interstate commerce, he's going to do much better off than someone with fewer weapons, maybe without those malevolent purposes, which just doesn't make any sense at all. I mean, the goal of the guidelines, obviously, is to punish the illegal possession of firearms. And I assert to you, Christopher Jones is just as dangerous on the street with a gun that traveled in interstate commerce as he is with a gun that was manufactured in the state of Illinois, or that we can't prove traveled in interstate commerce. And so for all of those reasons, Your Honor, we ask that the defendant's sentence be affirmed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Stahm, I think your time has expired, but you may have an additional minute.
In some of the government's examples, he's absolutely correct that if those cases tried to be charged in a federal court, that person may get a lesser sentence that had less guns. But that's not the dilemma that's before this court, because there are many cases, horrible crimes, that cannot get federal jurisdiction, and they're charged in the state system. And all the examples used by Mr. Chapman of issues that would arise if, in fact, we couldn't use that enhancement if we had to show it traveled in interstate commerce, the state system could take that slack up.
Zami, you started your argument, as I recall, by saying the alleged substandard performance resulted in additional time.
Yes.
And that's premised on what? Reliance on the rifle?
Yes.
All right. Well, if we took the rifle away, the pistol, wouldn't that have put the same number? I mean, if you're the defense counsel, and you challenge the rifle, I know you weren't the defense counsel below. You don't think that the judge would take the obliteration of the pistol into account?
Well, according to the way he ruled, and according to the probation officer's view that it would be double counting, I would say that he wouldn't have at that point used the FAG. That's why he didn't use the FAG originally, the probation officer. He said because that would be double counting, and it seems that Judge Lindbergh agreed with that. So I'm not so sure that it would have been viewed that way. And regarding the government's argument about the FAG, well, I think they waived that. So...
All right.
Thank you.
Well, our thanks to all Counsel Chapman, Ms. Bonamici, Ms. Dobb, and an additional thanks to you for accepting the assignment and in this court. The case is taken under advisement.